You're listening to the Voice of Russia in London. I'm Alice Lanyado. Welcome to Curtain Up, the programme that tells you about Russian culture in the capital. We've got news and views about London's most exciting exhibitions, films, plays and concerts with a Russian flavour. With me in the studio today is my co-host Julian Gallant, the director of Pushkin House in London, and our guest today is Professor John Milner of the Courtauld Institute of Art. So welcome to the programme, John. You're about to launch a two-day conference on the 2nd of November at the Courtauld Institute called Russian Culture in Exile. Why Russian Culture in Exile? Why did you want to hold an event on this theme?
It's clear for anyone who studies this history of 20th century Russian culture that emigration is a big feature of it. And, of course, Russians leaving because they were stranded in the West by World War I, World War II, or Russians leaving as dissidents, or Russians leaving the story because they've been sent to the Gulag. These are all emigrations and exile, in a way. So it led to different histories of Russian art and different mixtures of people. So we thought that it was important to look at this Russian art outside Russia theme and how it grows, if it's successful and independent. Is it a kind of exile, really, in that sense, or do these people rather be abroad anyway? And each exile, each wave of exile, be it internal to the Soviet Union or Russia or to Western Europe and America or Israel more recently, has its own qualities, and they're all different. So, I mean, at the moment, we live in a time when immigration is temporary. Russians can come and go. They go back to Russia. They buy properties here. They're citizens of the world, in a sense. But it's still a kind of temporary emigration.
It's certainly a late phenomenon as well.
Yes,
it's 1990s and right through. It's going on right now, isn't it?
Yes. But, of course, for a lot of the 20th century, there really was something like an iron curtain, and it was very, very difficult to cross it. And when people emigrated earlier in the century, they didn't always adjust to the new Soviet regime, for example. They probably left it because they wished to. And there was no reason why they should adjust to it in the West. So we have, coming out of this, the phenomenon of a separate Russian culture outside Russia from that one inside, but just as Russian.
I mean, Chagall always identified himself, didn't he? Russian more than anything else.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, the people who even kept a Soviet passport and renewed it. Goncharova was such a person. She left all her collection to the Tretyakov Gallery at the end of her life, and she hadn't been in Russia since 1914.
I've got a question about Natalia Goncharova and Chagall as well. They drew a lot on Russian folk themes in their work.
Yes.
And this was popular at the time. This was something that was done as much as constructivism and cubism.
Yes, exactly.
I wanted to ask you, how much did that tradition of drawing on folk traditions continue for those artists when they found themselves in exile?
On the whole, if anything, it emphasised that tendency. I mean, if you want to look at it historically, there was a big urge or surge just before World War I to recognise, if you like, low-level art, folk art.
That was a Europe-wide thing, wasn't it? Nationalism, isn't it?
Yes, but it
across the arts, isn't it?
It was nationalism in each country, if you see what I mean. Yeah. But the phenomenon was international. And the idea that somehow in folk culture there's a national identity, go back to your forebears and all the rest, was very strong. And there were strong movements, pro-Slav movements, for example, in Russia, and a great deal of work was produced, of course, with a folk element or even a peasant element and popular woodcuts. For the great anniversary of the Romanov dynasty in 1913, the entire court were obliged to wear traditional clothes at one point. So that was extremely colourful assertion of Romanov power. But, of course, it didn't stick. Well, a few years later, it was gone. But,
was the language coming back as well? Was the Russian language was coming into common parlance in the upper echelons of society, or was it still, were they still speaking French and German and English?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, Pushkin played a role in that as a great national figure. Mm. But partly there, Julian, you touch upon the fascinating dichotomy between culture in Moscow and culture in St. Petersburg. And the mystery that is there because, of course, Peter the Great founded St. Petersburg as an act of will and produced a profound schism, really, a break in old ways of thinking, old ways of working, and Moscow remained very much the spiritual center and the old capital, and this has never quite gone away. Pretty well, the only undemned church is only one, I think, in St. Petersburg.
And it really clashes, doesn't it, with the
yes,
with
the it's cities, a memorial it's to where one of the Tsars was blown up, but it looks like a bit of Moscow. So these are strong differences. Peter wanted Russia to be European, not just able to defend itself against Europe, but to push into Europe and assert itself. So from the art point of view, that began the whole business of teaching Russians to paint, if you like, in a foreign language, in a foreign style. And there were always this balance in every Russian, really, whether you're looking at Shostakovich or you know, Repin or whatever it is, between Russia as a Western European great culture of that kind, or whether it owes its identity to something more Asian in some ways. And Goncharov was one of the people who, in 1913, asserted that she wasn't going to deal with French art and so on anymore. It was going to be Asian, and that old Rus wasn't part of Peter's system and all the rest. So in that respect, you can glimpse something which is still around. I do have students who come from Moscow and some from St. Petersburg, and they get on quite well now, but they've been surprised in some ways, and occasionally reluctant to go to the other capital.
You're listening to the Voice of Russia in London. This is Curtain Up, the programme about Russian culture in the capital.
I notice on the conference, it goes from 1921 to 1953, which are very, very clear dates in Russian history for some of us. 1953, certainly, the death of Stalin.
Yes.
And 1921, of course, is later than the revolution. And what happened?
Yes,
what is 1921?
1921 is the year when diplomatic relations were established by the Soviet Union with most West European countries. And it meant that Soviet citizens could travel again. There was a big exhibition in Berlin in 1922 called the First Russian Art Exhibition at the Van Diemen Gallery, and that was a wave for quite a few artists, Gabo included, to emigrate because they came with the exhibition, exhibited works, and didn't return, some of them. But it was a big exhibition. It made a big impact, surprisingly, in Germany. It was one of the first countries to welcome the Russians in after World War I, even though there had been, of course, a failed German uprising.
You get the École de Paris as well, don't you?
Yes.
Which is quite clear. Are these Russian artists who emigrated because they didn't like Russia or simply because they preferred life in Paris?
They're mostly people who left when they could. In the early revolutionary years, it does seem to be impossible to say, you have to leave. Please let me leave. And a number of people did negotiate departures in that way. And Chagall was among them, in actual fact. He asked Lunacharsky, who fixed a passport. The railway line, of course, it's pretty well a continuous railway line from Moscow to Vitebsk to Warsaw to Berlin to Paris. So if you could do it, that was a way of doing it. Or by ship from Petrograd, as it was then called. So this was a major wave. There were pre-war Russians. Because, after all, Russia was quite a remarkable entrepreneurial society before World War I, before 1917. Mm. If you look at the old photographs, they're stuffed with shop signs and people in fairs, and in the big cities at least, it was a great commercial environment.
And some of that comes back in the 20s, doesn't it? Some of the invention, the excitement about the new life and the new, it comes back after the revolution in the 20s. And then the curtain comes down at the end of the 1920s when the unions are formed and the state starts to really get a grip on culture.
Yes, that's true. Another richness about exile and emigration there is that once the gates were opened for diplomatic exchanges and exhibitions and concerts and all this kind of thing, so there were Soviet Russians who travelled on a Soviet passport and came and went. And in the art world, Lisitsky was an important figure in that respect. And he travelled on missions in a way. I mean, he's a very remarkable artist. But he made collaborations with Dishtil and Van Doesburg and Mondrian, with the Bauhaus, with Schwitters, with all kinds of people. It was always a collaboration whenever he travelled, as if he needed something to show the external cultural outreach organization called Vox what he'd been doing. And that's quite interesting because he was selling the regime, but in quite a subtle way that made it seem reasonable and inventive. And yeah.
Well, I've got a question slightly related to that. I wanted to know how much artists who left Russia influenced art in the countries they made their new homes in. Mm. I know they'll all be different, but I wanted to ask you.
Some became very important figures, obviously. Some had Western links before all this.
So that helped them, contacts.
So Gabo in Germany and later in Britain and in America, now Gabo, promoted himself in a way as the Russian constructivist, but he didn't like most Russian constructivists who stayed behind because they were really assertively communist. And he thought art was above politics, or at least it was convenient to say that. But his brother, Anton, or Antoine Pevsner, moved to Paris. And Kandinsky was a figure who had become famous in Germany, of course, before World War I, and then moved to Russia during, well, when the revolution broke out, more or less, and didn't like it. He stayed there for something like 4 years, and he was eventually given a job in the museum's bureau. He took huge paintings with him. It was quite an undertaking. Major paintings, abstract paintings, if you like, that he made in Germany. And he distributed quite a lot of them. This museum's bureau invented, I think, 67 museums of modern art in 1919, making Russia the first country to have museums of modern art and the first country to get rid of them. Quite an interesting
thing.
Getting
rid of them when, though? In
well, they were... everything was nationally owned, of course.
Yes.
No one owned anything
no.
individually, or very few people. So,
and what about the artists left behind? I mean, we often talk in the West about some well-known names who are popular here, but there must have been so many talented artists who we know there were so many talented artists and other intellectuals who disappeared
in
the purges.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes. It's interesting that one should wonder where they were left behind from, if you see what I mean. Some were left behind in Europe, some were left Western Europe, some left behind in Russia. Well, the real challenge was communism had its very chaotic start, and I can never believe they had such astonishing ambitions. They wanted to take over the entire world. I can imagine a bunch of people wanting to be in power, but they had this fantastic vision.
It was a proselytizing religion, effectively, wasn't it?
And yes, they wanted to take over the entire universe. You know, there's a film called Aelita, which says, Workers of All Planets Unite, and they were really... It's part of the origin of the Russian space race thing, but the ideology was essentially very simple and very severe. And Russians either had to go along with it or not. They had to go along because all galleries were closed and disappeared. There was no commercial outlet for an artist, and there were and private possessions were firmly discouraged. There was even one man who spoke in favour of getting rid of shelves and cupboards because they promoted individual ownership. So everyone owned everything, and no one owned anything. The definition of what culture should do was that it had to be, you have to imagine you're a painter at this moment, it had to be collectively produced. So no one was to sit in their studio alone.
And paint.
With the paint dripping through the skylight and paint.
You're listening to the Voice of Russia in London. This is Curtain Up.
You had to work collectively with other people. So we get little groups forming. It had to be political. It had to support the regime, which argued that it was beyond politics. It was to liberate the entire world, get rid of politics. Still hear this kind of argument occasionally. Mm-hmm. And it was, therefore, to be political. Workers of the World Unite was a familiar inscription on paintings and banners, but it is also to be public in its manifestation. So street art immediately took off. And artists one thinks of as dedicated to the cause didn't really have an option. And it's quite interesting to look at artists' records before 1914, before 1917, see if they were politically outspoken. But on the other hand, it gave a few people great opportunities. So Vladimir Tatlin, for example, became a very powerful figure for a while. And, you know, he was pretty well in charge of visual arts in Petrograd, so he could... The hermitage was taken over for the people. You know, it was a big thing, and to decry the old regime was one useful way of surviving, but there really was only one patron. That was the slip.
That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. Thank you very much, Professor Milner, for coming in today.
My pleasure.
And I hope that listeners will come to your conference on the 2nd of November. This is The Voice of Russia in London. I'm Alice Lanyado. Stay with us.